This is the Horse Radio Network.
This is episode 101 of Horsemanship Radio, brought to you by Omega Fields, the world's best omega-3 supplements for horses. Horsemanship Radio is part of the family of the Horse Radio Network, and I think you're going to have fun with some of these people that we talked to today, all the way from the filmmaking world to the rescue world. This is Debbie Laux, and you're listening to The Horsemanship Radio. Thanks for joining us. Horsemanship Radio airs on the 1st and the 15th of the month, and I have my producer, Coach Jen, with me today. Hi, Jen.
Hello. How's Debbie?
I'm good. Why? We had fun making this episode. I'm really excited for people to get to hear these people. So we had kind of a party.
this was a party.
Kind of a party. Yeah. I remember when we were recording Bev and Aaron, who we'll introduce shortly here. I was up in Oregon with the Polo Association, overlooking this beautiful Washington and Oregon, the Columbia River dividing them, and these windsurfers, and they were so ready for this fundraiser they were going to do. And it was just really cool to get to know them and their heart for horses and thoroughbreds and charity and everything. And then you and I got to interview Stefan Morrell, who's a renowned filmmaker. And what he said about what he learned from horses just gave me chills. It was really cool.
Yeah. And they kind of go hand in hand, because Stefan is making films that are going to go so far beyond the equestrian community.
Yeah.
Right? And that's something we need to do, because the equestrian community, the horse industry, has been kind of keeping its head down for too long. We need to welcome the world in.
Yeah.
And then, which helps us to preserve our passion. And then Bev and
Aaron. Yeah.
Are at the other side of that, where they're bringing horses who have fallen onto hard times as far as being responsibly cared for, and mm-hmm. they are bringing them back into the fold, so to speak. So
Yeah. And really good point about outreach too, because Stefan is reaching a whole new audience that Aaron and Bev probably couldn't, and repurposing. There's a theme of repurposing in here too, which I just love. So yeah, people can have fun.
Yeah. All right. We'll get started right after we hear from our very important title sponsors, Omega Fields.
Your horse is your partner in sport, in leisure, and just in life. To keep him at his peak performance and optimal health, a solid nutritional foundation is key. Ideally, horses are able to graze fresh, growing grasses, which most closely mimic their natural diet. But that may not always be possible, and we may need to supply some of those missing ingredients in today's diets and provide more functional foods. One component of a horse's diet that is often underfed are omega-3 fatty acids. While more prevalent in fresh forages, harvested forages are lower in omega-3 fatty acids due to their more advanced maturity. Obviously, grasses and legumes have to grow to a sufficient height in order to be harvested, while foraging patterns of horses show great preference for shorter, less mature plants. That's why modern horsemen and horsewomen trust Omega Horseshine to provide a powerful, bountiful source of omega-3 fatty acids for their equine partners. Look for Omega Horseshine from Omega Fields at your local tack and feed supplier, or you can find them online at omegafields.com.
Bev Strauss is co-founder and director of Mid-Atlantic Horse Rescue. Graduate A in Pony Club, grew up riding thoroughbreds, eventing, hunting, etc. She gravitated to the track, was training at Delaware, and my good friend Jenny Suarez realized that thoroughbreds left for the New Holland auction and off to slaughter every Sunday. They wanted to make a change. So they started in September 2002 with $2,000. They bought 3 thoroughbreds, rented a 3-acre field, and just pulled themselves up by their bootstraps, and they have now placed over 1,200 thoroughbreds in the Delaware Park and Maryland Jockey Club area, and they're transitioning horses out of feedlots and into people's homes. It's really cool. Aaron Crady is the executive director of Thoroughbred Charities of America in Lexington, Kentucky. Now, Aaron is a graduate of the St. Lawrence University in New York and holds a Master of Arts in Media Communications. Aaron joined the Thoroughbred Owners and Breeders Association in 2006 as Director of Marketing and Communications. In October 2009, Aaron took the reins as Executive Director at TCA. And prior to joining TOBA, TOBA and TCA, Aaron worked as an account executive and media buyer for Group 5 Advertising in Gainesville, Florida. So she's well-rounded. She also worked as an account executive for an online gaming company in New York, New York. So you get the racing side of it. Welcome, Bev Strauss and Aaron Crady.
Well, welcome. I've got Bev Strauss and I've got Aaron Crady, a very fortunate group here to get to work with Thoroughbreds. And I'm so lucky to have you on. So first, I'm going to have Aaron say hi so you get her voice in here. Hi, Aaron.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Aaron is a part of the TCA, which is the Thoroughbred Charities of America. I'm really happy to have you on. And we've got Bev Strauss. Say hi, Bev.
Hey there, everybody.
That's nice. Bev is the co-founder and president of a Thoroughbred charity called Mid-Atlantic Horse Rescue. And I'm so happy to have two very instrumental women helping horses on today. And I hope that this will actually influence all our listeners out there to really see, maybe you don't have a Thoroughbred, or maybe you don't even know too much about Thoroughbreds, but to see the versatility of Thoroughbreds and the ability of people to repurpose Thoroughbreds for a longer life and a longer career. So, Aaron, I'd love to start with you. How did you get hooked up first with Thoroughbred Charities of America? Are you a horse girl?
I am. I actually grew up riding hunter jumpers, and I don't currently own a horse, but the last horse I did own, she was an off-the-track thoroughbred. She made, a grand total of maybe about $900. So let's say she just did not excel on the track, but she was an incredible equitation horse. So, yes, I got the horse bug as a young girl, and I'm lucky enough now to sort of blend my passion with my profession. So I'm very, very fortunate to be a part of Thoroughbred Charities of America.
Yes, you are. And it is a passion, I am sure. But you're doing great things. So describe to us, the listener who doesn't know about TCA, what the purpose of Thoroughbred Charities of America is and how long you've been around too.
Yep, sure. We were actually founded in 1990 in Middletown, Delaware by a couple called, their names are Herb and Ellen Mollis, as well as their friend, the late Allaire DuPont. Mm-hmm. And the story goes that Allaire was alerted to some abandoned horses and said, you know what, Herb and Ellen, we've got to do something to help these horses. Herb and Ellen threw a dinner party at their home and auctioned off some artwork mm-hmm. and provided the funding from those items to help the horses. And from there, you know, in 1990 to here today, TCA has just grown and grown and grown. We are now the charitable arm of the Thoroughbred Owners and Breeders Association. And essentially, our mission is to provide a better life for thoroughbreds by supporting qualified repurposing and retirement organizations, but also importantly by helping people who care for thoroughbreds. Mm-hmm. The way we go about doing that is we are a grant-making organization, so we're kind of like the United Way of the thoroughbred industry. We raise funds and then we distribute those funds via an annual grant application process. And it's quite a rigorous process, as Bev can probably attest to, but we feel very strongly that it is our duty to be a good steward of any funding that comes to us. So then we, of course, have to be very diligent about how we distribute that funding. So we have a great process in place to review grant applications, make sure our applicants and then subsequently our grant recipients meet all of our criteria for a grant.
Mm-hmm. So, Beverly, when you came up against this formidable application for grants, what did you think? Did you think, oh my gosh, they're this is awfully invasive to ask all this stuff of us? And how did that first grant go?
Well, actually, if you sort of go back, we started the rescue, Mid-Atlantic Horse Rescue, in 2002. A good friend of mine, Ginny Suarez, and I were both training racehorses at Delaware Park on a small scale, and we knew how many horses were heading off to low-end auctions mm-hmm. every Sunday at the end, at the end of the week.
What's a low-end auction? It's not a good.
It's not a good thing. It's a livestock auction where many and probably the majority of these horses are sold for slaughter. So Ginny and I knew how many horses were leaving the track every week, and we wanted to do something. We decided to start a rescue. We talked about it all summer. We had a concept. And in September of 2002, there were, I think, 27 thoroughbreds at the local auction that day. And I called Ginny and I said, you know what, if we're going to do this, today's the day. Mm-hmm. So we pulled together a little money, and actually we got a little bit of seed money, a tiny bit of seed money from Mrs. DuPont. And we went and bought 3 horses. And then all of a sudden we said, oh my gosh, mm-hmm. we need a name. We need a website. We need this, that, and the other thing. We rented a 3-acre field with a shed. And about 2 weeks later, Ginny and I took our pictures and our hearts on our sleeves. And we went and called Herb and Ellen Mullis and said, this is what we want to do. Can you help? And TCA gave us our very first grant back then. I think it was $5,000, and that was huge to us.
Mm-hmm.
So the initial grant was basically sit down face-to-face. This is what we want to do. And they supported us 100%. And they've done so every year since then. Now, it has become a rigorous application process, but, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Because it makes us really watch what we're doing as far as, crossing the T's, dotting the I's, but it just ensures that the money is being well spent. To me, if you're an organization that can't complete this process, you shouldn't be receiving funding, because the public gives their money faithfully, donates to TCA, and again, they expect TCA to spend the money wisely. And if you're an organization that's not well run as a business, knowledgeable, et cetera, those are organizations that should not be getting the funding. So,
sure.
Yeah, it's rigorous, but it's well worth it.
That's great. Yeah. So the public knows that what they're seeing is good horsemanship when you're yes. taking care of these horses. Your experience. And so we know what breaks Bev's heart, and we know how you got started. I love that you didn't wait to get ready and get your website up first before you rescued a horse, I love that. So Erin, what breaks your heart? What was like the first charitable work that you did in your life?
Oh my goodness. I've just always had a soft spot for animals. They just get to me. I can't pinpoint one sort of event, but I've always been surrounded by animals, and it pains me when I can't offer more help. We're actually quite involved with the Hurricane Maria efforts in Puerto Rico right now, trying to assist with the 800 plus thoroughbreds there at the racetrack, and logistically it's become quite the challenge, and it's breaking my heart right now that I can't get in there sooner and get the aid to these horses that they so desperately need. So I just, seeing a need and not being able to immediately fulfill it, it's tough, but at the same time we certainly do the best we can with our limited resources, but that said, everything that we do is thanks to our donors. We are 100% charitable organization. So the aid that we do expend in the form of grants each year, you know, is 100% due to some wonderful supportive donors that we have. And, you know, over the last 27 years of TCA, we've granted over $22 million to charities across the country. So, you know, that's certainly something to be proud of, and we work very hard to accomplish that each year.
How many Thoroughbred industry-related nonprofits do you probably work with every year? How many do you give grants to?
Yeah, it varies a little bit year by year. This year, we had 71 grant recipients across the country. And keep in mind, that's in collectively called aftercare, you know, the horse care side of it. But we also support organizations that are working on the backstretch of racetracks or on the farms, you know, to provide health and human services for the individuals that are caring for the thoroughbreds, because it's often underserved population. So more than 50% of our funding does go to the horse side of it, but we also do support the human side as well. Additionally, a smaller percentage of our funding goes to equine-assisted therapy programs that are using thoroughbreds within their programs.
Oh, fantastic, too. So you're repurposing all of this. And I love that you help the families, too. These are the people that are directly working with those horses on the track. And it's so important that they felt like they belong there, too. I always worry about the grooms more than I worry about the owners. You know, the people that are actually hands-on working with the horses, you can educate the owners and the trainers, in the case of thoroughbreds on the track. But really, the trickle-down is what I worry about. It's what keeps me up at night, is are those guys that clean the stalls, are they aware of your compassion and you know, how much you care about the horses? So if you're involved in their lives, that's just another indicator. I think that's wonderful.
Yeah, we are. There's some great organizations out there that are working to provide medical services, dental services, even just providing communications options, you know, computer labs and phones and that sort of thing to many of the backstretch workers, because many of them still are immigrants and have families in other countries. So for them to be able to communicate with their families, you know, I think it makes their day a little bit brighter for sure.
Yeah.
Go
ahead, Beth. Yeah.
I'm sorry. The one thing I've noticed, you know, right now we're based at Delaware Park with our one horse in our racing stable. But the thing that always strikes me is these hot walkers and grooms, valets, whatever, they are so dedicated to these horses that they don't own. And, you know, they look at every little detail. I mean, it's really, they're the success behind these horses, and they're they're unsung heroes. You know, we look at all these different grooms. A lot of them don't speak English, and they really care about their horses. You know, they cry when the horse gets claimed away or the horse goes home to the farm, and, you know, they take pride in these horses, and it's just, they're phenomenal people collectively. It's very rewarding to see that.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And then when you get them, they've been handled nicely. So tell us about Mid-Atlantic Horse Rescue, Bev, and maybe give us a real story between what TCA has been able to do in awarding grants to you and then what you've been able to do that's over and above. I mean, you're one of 71 out of all the, I'm sure, applications, and I won't even ask how many you get, that TCA does. Tell us, get a little personal with us about the horses.
Oh, boy. How long do you have? I mean, there's so many stories. You know, that very first day when we decided it was the time to act and start Mid-Atlantic Horse Rescue, we had to choose 3 out of the 27. And that wasn't easy to do because we knew the fate of the others was bleak. You know, we started with the 3 horses in the rented 3-acre field. Over the years, we've pulled ourselves up by our bootstraps. We're now on 160 acres, and we've got 40 horses at a given time. We've placed over 1,200 horses. Plus, in addition to providing safe haven, we'll get thoroughbreds for other valid, legitimate rescues and send them off because we can't handle them all. But, it's just been amazing, the support of a group like TCA who had faith in us from the very beginning and has continued to have faith. It's made our job easier because it's not always easy. You know, we always have to pick and choose horses that we can save, and that's hard. A personal story. You know, we've been pulling horses for a while from kill pens, and I guess it was maybe, I'm trying to think what year it might have been. It's got to be at least 10 years now. We pulled a horse out of the kill pen that we didn't have room for, but I ran his tattoo and found out that he had been the Pennsylvania bred champion 2-year-old, and he had been on the Triple Crown trail. And, you know, he had ankles. He was maybe 8 at the time, had done his running, had made $250,000. Wow. This horse had so much class. And so we pulled him, and I thought, well, I'm sure somebody from his past will want to help him. You know, we didn't have room for him, but we bought him. I actually sent him to my friends up at Akendale, another accredited rescue, because we didn't have room. And it was about 4 months later, and unfortunately, his former racing connections weren't interested in helping him or weren't able to help him. And about 4 months later, I was looking for a personal horse of my own. And this horse had always just struck me. I just always liked him, even though I'd only spent, you know, maybe an hour with him total before he left for Akendale. So I called Erin, who was running the program at the time, and I said, what's his story? Is he sound? She said, oh, he's pretty sound. So I adopted him, brought him home, and he became my heart horse.
Your heart horse. I love it.
Oh, I adore this horse. He's tough. He's handsome. He's just the most handsome horse I've ever seen. You know, I brought him home, and he promptly, I realized how hard he was to ride, but we did quite well. And now he's retired at my farm. You know, we have a small farm, and, you know, every day when I see him, he makes me smile. And here's a horse that, you know, almost was lost. And yeah. I just know how much joy he gives to me. And I know, you know, out of the horses we've placed with our adopters, they feel the same way about their horses.
Yeah, do they?
You know, but it is hard because we do have to pick and choose. It's hard to know which horses we can help, which ones we can't. We do as many as we can, but it's also important not to bring in too many so that we end up not doing the right thing for the horses that we do have in our program.
Bless your heart for knowing the difference. I do appreciate that, and I hope people appreciate that listening to you too. Is there... You know, you need somebody in the BEV position that really knows on the ground, boots on the ground, what you can do best, what you can do best with each horse. And how do you find your adopters, Bev?
A lot of it now is word of mouth. Initially, we did print advertising, now social media. The RRP brings in a lot of people. But it's just a lot of it's word of mouth. People have heard that. You know, we've done a good job, or something, my friend got a horse from you, that kind of thing. We really pride ourselves on matching the horse with the rider, because if you put a horse in a home where it's not perfectly suited, it's just not going to work out for the horse or the person. And a horse is a huge commitment. So, you know, if I have an older woman who wants a quiet trail horse, I'm not going to send her a hot little mare.
Yeah.
If I've got a kid who wants to go jump the moon, I'm going to make sure that that horse is sound and willing and able to do that. The one thing that we've always done is we've tried to save the horses that are adoptable, because if we take in the old lame, I mean, I'm not saying that we don't have some older lame horses, we do, but if we target, you know, the old lame horse that's never going to find a home, we can help that horse for its life. If we pull a horse that is, you know, young and sound and can go on, we can adopt that horse out, turn around and go get another.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's very important to be able to adopt these horses out to spread the burden. You know, we do have some sanctuary horses at our farm, which, you know, I don't know if we'll ever find homes, and they'll live out their lives with us, but we really, you know, while we have those horses, these young sound horses are often getting lost. So, you know, it's really a numbers game. You've got to look at your finances, your help, the number of adopters, the donors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need to get these horses out into homes doing things. And that really raises the awareness of the thoroughbred. And then, you know, more people say, oh, I want a thoroughbred too.
Right. Yeah. That it's possible. Yeah. That they, you know, a lot of people look down on racing. You know, it has its detractors. We'll just be real honest here. But I think that you can only be hopeless if you don't know that there are actually, ways that you can make a difference. And I think people have figured that out in the greyhound racing industry. And so they can certainly figure it out in the thoroughbred industry if you care to reach out. One of the developments that I love that I've been hearing about is the thoroughbred makeover, which brings it to a more public arena, doesn't it? It brings it to the public awareness. It's not just a word of mouth or one-off thing. And I understand that TCA is sponsor? Are you the head sponsor, Erin?
We are the title sponsor of the Retired Racehorse Project's Thoroughbred Makeover. The fifth annual makeover is occurring here in Lexington the first weekend of October. And it is such an incredible event. If anyone is ever in Lexington around that time of year, I highly encourage you to come out to the Kentucky Horse Park. And it's 4 days of about 500 recently off the track thoroughbreds trying their hearts out in 10 different disciplines. I mean, it's moving to see so many thoroughbreds all in one place competing and succeeding in a variety of different disciplines when they were on the track, you know, maybe less than a year ago. It's it's a really interesting event. I think the event at the horse park. It was, I feel like I had a little bit of a moment there because it was the finale. They were sort of presenting themselves in the arena for the final judging. And just to see these 10 thoroughbreds, top of their game, there they are at the, you know, grand stage in the Kentucky Horse Park. It was, I got a little teary eyed. I'm not going to lie. I mean, it's such a sweet thing. You know, and what the Retired Racehorse Project is doing, working to create a market for thoroughbreds, working to increase demand for thoroughbreds in the sport horse community. It's part of the equation, you know, and that's kind of what TCA's sort of mentality about that is, you know, thoroughbred aftercare to me, to TCA, encompasses two sides. First off, you know, you have to support the organizations like Mid-Atlantic, you know, what Bev's doing in retraining and rehoming, but we also have to support the other side of the equation, which is creating a demand and creating a market for these thoroughbreds to move into. So Bev has somewhere to move these thoroughbreds, you know, once they're retrained and kind of let down from the track. So it's really important to TCA to support both sides of that equation, and the Thoroughbred Makeover is certainly, you know, doing a really great job of getting some awareness and increasing the awareness and visibility of the thoroughbred.
That's fantastic. And so it sounds fun. Go ahead, Bev. Yeah, tell us about it.
Well, it's interesting because back when we started, I couldn't, you know, I thought, oh, everybody's going to want to know that these horses are going off to dark places and that they're going to want to help them. And, you know, aftercare was really a dirty word in the industry back in late 90s, early 2000s. And what we've seen, it's been wonderful. The industry is now embracing aftercare. You know, they have the Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance, which inspects and accredits rescues. You've got TCA, which supports rescues, and we've got racetracks that come to us now and have us help transition their horses. In fact, you know, we just were aware of a situation on Saturday where a trainer from a local track sold two horses to, quote unquote, a good home. And on Monday, they ended up at New Holland. I saw them there. They went to kill. We were able to buy them both back. The trainer had no idea, and the track actually called the trainer. It said, you know, I called the track. They called the trainer and said, look, these horses are in trouble. You need to act. So it's just been a phenomenal turnaround for the industry, and we're grateful for that. But the one element that was missing all along was the marketing of thoroughbreds. You know, because it seems like every breed organization has an association which markets their horses. I think the Haflinger Association, their slogan is more than just beautiful hair, you know, and we didn't have something for the thoroughbreds. So when Stuart Pittman started the Retired Racehorse Project, that was such an outlet, and we're so grateful for TCA to pick up the ball here and support RRP and create this market. It's because everyone wants a thoroughbred now, and that's wonderful. That, you know, we're seeing horses leaving the track into good homes directly. The horsemen are able to stop racing their horses earlier and sell them for money to good homes to go on and be sport horses. And, you know, TCA's support of the makeover and the Retired Racehorse Project is huge because that was a missing piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, absolutely. You guys, it's so fun to hear light bulb moments, right? All these things are going off. And, and, you know, and we do, we tend to get, you know, kind of in our discipline walls, right? Our little echo chambers in one breed or one discipline. And you really are breaking through for the thoroughbred industry, but you're also going to influence those that haven't created their walls yet either. And I think this next generation is going to be much more cognizant of repurposing. And I love that thoroughbreds are going to polo, 3-day eventing. We just have some superheroes in those worlds. And I'm talking the horses now too, much less the people who are willing, professionals who are putting their heart and soul and time and resources into repurposed thoroughbreds, OTTBs, off the track thoroughbreds, how, you know, whatever you guys want to grab out there. I don't care. You know, if they're repurposing a thoroughbred that doesn't go to slaughter, better and better. And listen up, the countries that maybe don't have associations doing that right now. Any listeners out there that want to start what Bev and Aaron are able to do, you know that Bev says just do it first and then organize second. You could do it too. And I love it. I love it. It's about the horses and you guys are living it. So I'm so proud of you and really excited to have you on. I want to hear more about. So TCA, what's your grant cycle, Aaron? And, you know, and when can we help? What can we do to help?
Sure, sure. Well, if there are any listeners out there that have a thoroughbred rescue and, you know, are in need of potential funding, our grant application becomes available on our website. That's tca.org. Each January, thereabouts, January 15th or so, and it is there for download and completion. Then it is due to me on March 15th, so it has to be in my office with all of the parts and pieces included, one complete grant application into my office in March. Then we being myself and my grants committee, which is comprised of five of our board members, we go through each and every application and review and determine, you know, if the applicant meets our criteria, then grants are distributed by the end of June. So that's kind of the annual cycle there, but important to note again, you know, we would not be able to do what we do without our donors. And that said, our largest annual fundraiser does occur every January. It's a stallion season auction. So if there are any thoroughbred breeders out there, please consider the TCA stallion season auction as a source for your stallion needs. We have usually about 200 or so stallion seasons from thoroughbreds in 10 plus states at varying price points. So it's a great opportunity there to perhaps get some good deals on some seasons. But then additionally, we offer some items for those people that want to support TCA but maybe aren't in the thoroughbred breeding world. So we offer, you know, trips and racing experiences, memorabilia, that sort of thing available in an online auction.
Oh, fun. We all love those. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's where our competitive spirit comes out. Really fun. That's fun. And Bev, tell people why your resource for rescue horses you'll be first in line at the TCA grant cycle, first of all, and what you're coming up with next year. Are you able to grow, take in more horses, or could you always use more funds?
We could always use more funds. We can always use more room, more people. It's, you know, we've been very careful to grow as we can. You know, we started with 3 horses. It was basically Ginny and I, and then we, you know, added a field here and there. We added part-time help. You know, we initially, out of the 3, we adopted the first horse that December and then went and bought one more. And it got so we could go, we would adopt 2 and get 3 more and adopt 3 and get 5 more. That's how we've grown. And we're at a point right now where we are pretty maxed out with our resources that we have, with the numbers of horses we have. We do have more of the farm available to us, but we're not quite there yet financially or from a manpower standpoint to expand. So what we've done this year is we started using two different satellite farms with qualified trainers that I know personally that know and love thoroughbreds. What we're starting to do is send a couple of horses here and there to these other farms to continue their retraining and to get adopted out from there. Those farms are also inspected and accredited, so it's a pretty stringent process. But that's what we're trying to do now, is grow that way until we get to the point where we can fence in the remaining 70 acres and take in another 20 or 30 horses.
Okay, you're going to have to take your vitamins.
So it's, yeah.
busy
it's hard because I've got an amazing team of people. You know, it's a small and mighty team. My board is wonderful. They're very supportive. And then we've got, you know, our farm manager and a couple of volunteers and a couple of paid employees, and everybody just rolls up their sleeves and does whatever has to be done. And we couldn't have that success without these people, you know, working as a team together. I don't want to stress them out by saying, oh, guess what? We're going to fence in those other fields and we're going to buy, you know, 20 more horses. But we want to continue to grow in a methodical manner because we don't want to fail.
Good.
So, you know, we count on funding from, you know, the thoroughbred industry, TCA and TAA, to help us achieve that goal. And then we count on our private donors and we count on our adopters, you know, to walk around these horse shows saying, I love my horse. I got him from Mid-Atlantic.
Right. You have a little sticker that you put on their hips or anything? Is this, you know, I was adopted from the Mid-Atlantic Horse Rescue.
we give our adopters custom saddle pads with our logo on them. And sometimes that's a curse. Sometimes that's a blessing.
Oh.
You know, we say if your horse is going to misbehave, well, that's the excuse. If he's going to be a star, well, that's the excuse.
Sorry. Good one. Good one. Well, they can find you at what website do you want people to go to?
Our website is midatlantichorserescue.org. We're based in Chesapeake City, Maryland. And we welcome visitors at any time. We just have to, you know, you can give us a call and we open up the farm. We had a really nice little girl yesterday. She's 8 years old. For her birthday, she collected $285 for our horses.
Aww.
So it's just really neat. As you said, the next generation is coming along and interested in repurposing horses and interested in thoroughbreds. And that's what we want to enable.
Love it. Yeah, love it. That's wonderful. And if people want to do matching TCA grants, how do they get a hold of you at the TCA?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. We always graciously accept donations of any size. Our website is tca.org. We are located here in Lexington, Kentucky, and anyone can reach out to me at any time, and I would be happy to talk about all things thoroughbreds and TCA.
Nice. Spoken like a great executive director at TCA. Thank you for that. Well, both of you, thank you so much for illuminating us about Thoroughbred Rescue and how much potential there is out there and where people can go to find just a fabulous horse. So I thank you guys for both being on the show today in Horsemanship Radio.
Hi, Carol Herder here, president of Cavallo, home of the world's most trusted and popular hoof boots. You know, one of the most interesting parts of what I do is the many horsey stories I get to hear. Most of them are really uplifting. Some are stories of challenges, and a few are downright sad. Recently, a wonderful woman took the time to approach us at a show to share a story about her horse who went down in quicksand. It started out as a really scary story. We were holding our breaths, waiting for the outcome, and it turned out wonderful. They winched the horse out relatively unscathed, albeit, you know, a little traumatized, and everyone standing around were super amazed that he still had his Cavallo hoof boots on. Scary story with a good ending. Another testament to Cavallo. If you don't have a pair for your horse, it's time. Cavallos are easy to put on, easy to take off when you want to take them off, and they stay on. They stay on in all terrain. Cavallo, the world's most trusted hoof boots.
Stéphane Morel is an award-winning documentary filmmaker, and he adds the title of honorary gaucho to his introductions. He's so cute. Through his films, Stéphane's intuitive understanding of storytelling helps his audience share the feeling of being involved in the story. Stéphane is a director, a cinematographer, a photographer, an editor, and a writer, too. His movies like Blind Spot and Herd, H-E-R-D, bring a global audience to his portfolio and have earned him many awards. Well, welcome, Stéphane Morel. You're just an award-winning documentary filmmaker, and I am so happy to have you on Horsemanship Radio. Where do you hail from right now, Stéphane?
I'm originally from Montreal, Quebec, Canada. I currently live in Toronto, Ontario, which may not quite be the horse country that you live in, but it's a pretty dynamic horse country.
It really is. And you're a horse guy, which is what makes this really a fun interview, because we get the artsy side, which all horsewomen love, and we get the horsey side, which all women are deprived of in most men that they know these days. So I'm excited to have you on. We were fortunate enough to be at the Equus International Film Festival in Missoula, Montana, and meet you there and witness the award that you won with movies, and we can get into that a little bit. But first, I want to introduce you as a horse person, because you are a competitor even. You don't just love horses, and you don't just ride horses. You actually compete. So tell us a little bit about your horsey background.
Well, you know, it all started with a tangle lesson, frankly. Many years ago, I was planning a trip to Argentina, and my wife and I figured, well, they have horses there, so we should probably take a riding lesson or two along with the tangle lesson. And sure enough, it didn't take long for me to catch the horsemanship fever and traveled to Argentina, spent a tremendous amount of time in northern Patagonia, came back, continued with my apprenticeship as a horseman, did a lot of work in natural horsemanship as well as classical training in dressage and hunter jumper. I currently compete in combined events, so that's sort of my introduction towards cross-country three-day eventing, but for now I'm still just doing stadium jumping and dressage events.
And do you spend more time doing that or filmmaking?
You know, well, I would have to say that I'm blessed to have the luxury of a work schedule that allows me to spend as much time with the barn with the horses as I possibly can, because being an artist and self-employed, it means that I can come home and work in the dark through the night and spend my day, if possible, with the horses. It's a split for sure. But, you know, somebody asked me if I believed myself to be a horseman first or a filmmaker first. Mm-hmm. And I suppose the simple answer to that is that I'm a filmmaker first, at least in practical terms, because I've been making films ever since I was a kid, whereas I was introduced to horses quite late in life, relatively speaking, certainly compared to yourself and Monty. But, you know, thinking about it a little bit further, while it may be true that chronologically speaking, film came first, I would have to say that I'm probably a horseman first, because it's in my blood in a way that nothing else can ever be. It defines so much of how I view the world, how I interact with others, and it most definitely informs how I work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that resonates with me. You just told us right before we started recording this that you just came in from the barn, that you just had your head in a really good space for this interview. And that's what horses do for us, I suppose. And you could probably carry that over to your work then. Do you use the horses to kind of get in a good space for your editing?
You know, I'm a documentary filmmaker most of the time. I pay the bills by directing TV commercials. Mm-hmm. Documentary filmmaking isn't necessarily the most lucrative choice of a career, but it's most definitely the most rewarding emotionally and mostly creatively. And the reason I'm mentioning that is because as a documentarian, my sole purpose is to be a fly on the wall, whether it's to spend time telling story A, B, or C. I need to be as invisible and discreet as possible, mm-hmm. but also as present as possible. I need to be attentive, intuitive, engaged with the subject. And when it comes to working with horses, outside of my work as a filmmaker, obviously being present and being connected and being engaging in a dialogue with the horse is key to the success of a ride and to that relationship. And that absolutely translates to my work as a filmmaker, whether it's in an interview with someone who's never been in front of a camera before, or someone who has a great deal of experience in front of the camera, or if it's simply being out in the middle of nowhere, getting still lives of, you know, landscapes or whatever. Mm-hmm. The key to my finding my way as an artist and as a filmmaker is in being present, and horses teach me that.
I love that. And the energy of the horses seems to direct how your next move goes. It seems like you, in the movies that I've seen, it seems to be a pace that you set in each film, a little bit different on each. They're documentaries, but do you think that the energy of the horses on the set, as it happens, you can't fake horses on the set, do you think that does direct your film a little bit?
Well, the difference, I suppose, between the type of films that I make, documentaries, versus an action film or fiction, where there might be horses in the story, I don't stage what's going to happen. Mm. I have to anticipate. I have to just follow with the flow of the events that are unfolding before me. There's a certain degree of control to the situation, given the different contexts, whether it's in a quote-unquote control setting like a barn or an arena or a farm or a ranch versus out in the middle of the Andes or in the outback of British Columbia. Mm-hmm. I in both cases, I need to simply adapt to the situation I'm in. I'm not working with trained horses. By trained horses, I mean I'm not working with stunt horses.
Yeah.
So when it comes to answering your question about following the energy of the horses, I absolutely need to be to respond to what they're saying and where they're leading me. However, I'm not teaching you anything. I'm not telling you anything you don't know about working with horses. It's not just about being out of their way. It's also understanding how to create that dance, where there's a beautiful balance, and I keep using the word dialogue, but there's a beautiful balance between you holding your space and guiding the energy of the experience, of the interaction, as well as receiving the cues that they give you, so that it's not them deciding or you deciding, it's truly a collaborative effort. I think, you and I had once talked about natural horsemanship, and you asked me what it was for me, and I've been thinking about it since we spoke. And I believe that natural horsemanship, first and foremost, is really a conversation. The emphasis can easily be placed on the human half of the human horsemanship equation, but I don't think that's accurate. I think the only way natural horsemanship, and by natural horsemanship I mean working with nonviolent methods and as few artificial aids as possible, and perhaps even at liberty, mm-hmm. it's about finding that common language, whether it's verbal cues or physical cues or simply the presence that you can exert in that dynamic. That is what is the key for me to natural horsemanship. You don't need to be schooled in it, because I think children understand it instinctively when they walk up to a horse and, you know, extend their hand to give a carrot or a treat to the horse. That is an innate skill that we all have. Natural mm-hmm. horsemanship doesn't really need to be taught. If anything, I think we need to unlearn a lot of bad habits that we see, that we witness on television or in the movies or in, you know, traditional education of horse, around horses.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
There's never a moment where I'm not somehow putting the pieces together that are before me and turning them into some kind of a story or something that can inform whatever it is I'm working on. And that's probably more accurate. It's not so much that I'm necessarily thinking, okay, this could become something. It's more like this can inform what I'm doing now.
Yeah.
But, you know, mm-hmm. specifically when it comes to writing, you haven't asked me why I write. And I think mm-hmm. this is probably a good time to answer that question that you haven't yet asked, because it relates directly to what you're asking about whether or not I'm always working.
Mm-hmm.
I ride because it takes me away and out of myself.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is that I get out of my own way.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very meditative experience. Obviously, I don't need to tell you 101 things that you have to be thinking about while you're writing, whether mm-hmm. it's your position and this and that and this and that and this and that. And over time, so much of that becomes instinctive. So you don't need to actually be computing that information, but it's still something that occupies your mind.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I don't work when I'm writing. I'm not looking to tell a story. I'm not a filmmaker. I'm barely even a human. I'm the wind, as far as I'm concerned. When I'm anywhere near my horse, and certainly while I'm riding, and hopefully basking in the afterglow afterwards as well.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why I ride, because it takes me away from everything else. Which doesn't mean that I'm not present. If anything, I'm about as present, molecularly speaking, as I can possibly be in that very moment. That's what I think is the key to a successful relationship, certainly with a horse, but just in general.
I think that's a successful ride. I think that's why a lot of us ride anymore. Horses are recreational, right? There's very few people who use horses pound for pound in our society for their jobs. Plowing fields, et cetera. They're not tractors so much anymore. They're recreational. And that means that's choice based. That is our choice to get out there and be with a horse. And I think you just beautifully explained why a lot of people ride, because horses are in the present, aren't they? And we want to be that with them. We want to be in that present moment and get away from it all and come back refreshed. And I think your movies, let's get into those a little bit. I think your movies, sure. Your documentaries perfectly reflect that. Let's start with Blind Spot, just because I think The Herd actually, for me personally, touched me as much as any documentary has. And Blind Spot was harder to relate to at first. Why don't you give us a little bit of the, without me explaining, I'd rather have the filmmaker explain it. What you set out to do with Blind Spot, the three people that were involved, and the set the scene for us a little bit, and then tell us about that presence. Tell us why that film said that they had to be in the present to do that.
All right. Well, we can start with Blind Spot, the full title is Blind Spot Moments Unseen. And I'll tell you very briefly why the full title is Blind Spot Moments Unseen. The working title is Blind Spot, and I meant to use the words blind spot as a figurative term, mm-hmm. because it refers of course to our own literal and figurative blind spot, as well as that of a horse, but also it refers to what we don't see in life.
Right.
The moments unseen half of the title came about while we were on the trail. So let me back up now and tell you what the film is actually about.
Yeah.
The premise of the story is that three blind people who have virtually no experience around horses cross the Andes in Argentina by horseback. Now, they don't cross the Argentinian Andes on their own. They
engage
guides, and it wasn't a complete stunt.
Yeah. No, it's amazing, though. These people were really brave, I thought. I was surprised at yeah, they had ridden, but not a whole lot. You were brave, I think, to take that on, as any good, you know, Sherpa would be. But yeah, I mean, that's the scene set. Now, what did you set out to? What's the story you really wanted to tell? Or maybe you didn't know going in, like you said, you're a fly on the wall. So what was the take home for you on that?
Well, as you point out, in the case of any documentary, you can only control so much of the narrative ahead of time, because you never know what's going to happen. And God knows so many unexpected moments occurred during the making of that film, all of which were absolutely beautifully aligned with the creative genesis of the original idea, which was to find a new way of seeing. Mm-hmm. Hence the idea of including people who are visually impaired. You know, I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that I went to Argentina and I spent some time on horseback riding in Northern Patagonia. And for days and even for weeks, I never took a picture because I wasn't seeing anything that I had already seen in a book or in a movie. And as an artist, as a documentarian, as a filmmaker, and just as a thinking person, I'm always trying to find something that will educate me, but will also expand my way of thinking. And specifically in the case of my work, being an image maker, I'm looking for new ways of expressing myself visually. And the reason I wasn't taking any pictures, as I say, is because I wasn't seeing anything I hadn't already. So I wondered who could perhaps lead me to seeing in a new and more profound way. Mm-hmm. And that's where the idea of having someone who is visually impaired.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, that makes sense. That just touched my soul. That's amazing. As a horse person, you watch it for the things that can go wrong, I guess, maybe a little too much. But to explore those breakthroughs with them was just, I felt like a voyeur, you know, watching something really incredible unfold. And tell us about Herd, because it's very you. It's a beautiful film. It takes place in British Columbia, up in the hills. Yeah, and eight people participate in this collective, I think it was described as a collective spirit quest of meditation and equine therapy. All very different people, men, women. Tell me about your intent there.
Yeah, Herd is radically different in structure from Blind Spot Moments Unseen. Yet it shares one very common element, and of course, and it's the healing nature of horses. Mm. And it's funny because as I say that, I'm realizing what story with horses
isn't
a healing story.
Very good, very good.
You know, the healing power of horses.
Mm.
Yeah, well, the film all takes place at the Equinicity Retreat, which is a privately owned ranch just north of Kamloops in British Columbia by Liz Mitten Ryan, who's a lifelong horse person and artist. And she holds these, we'll call them an informal retreat or informal equine assisted environment retreat, where she has one herd of horses that are all related. So they're a family. They have family squabbles, as any good family might, but they also have a very unique disposition in that because they know each other, the hierarchy in the herd is clearly well established, and so they're extremely cooperative and more inclined, I think, to interact in a way that is beneficial to the people who attend these retreats. And the reason why people attend the retreat is to develop, for their own sake, a way of, it's a healing experience. These aren't people who have necessarily physical disabilities, which is often used in the case of, you know, equine-assisted experiences. They're not recovering from any particular trauma, or at least they're not the military veterans. But we all have our own issues that we need to work through, some of which are on the surface and some are considerably deeper that we don't face on a daily basis. So these people go there to spend time interacting with the herd of horses in order to become a communal herd of horses and humans, so that that reciprocity that I talked about from the very beginning and natural horsemanship and the dialogue, where it's not a one-way experience, but rather a shared one, is what occurs. And I document that in the film as meditatively, as you say, as possible. And by that, I mean, I'm not looking to simply exploit the visual qualities of horses, which are easy to attain because they're just such extraordinary animals. What I really wanted to do, and this took time and patience and stillness and mindfulness from me, was to be, I mentioned being invisible, as invisible and as discreet as possible while still holding my space, so that I could be a witness to the communion that takes place between the human and the horse. And you can see quite literally a physical change occurring in both creatures.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's what the film is about.
It's so good. It's so good. This reminds me of a question I wanted to ask you about too, because you said that working with horses has made you a better person and a better filmmaker, and you've answered that somewhat. But if you could answer that in just a sentence or two, what has it done to make you a better person? What are the attributes that you feel like you've taken on?
Well, you know that horses, of course, are prey animals, and humans are predators.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the magical characteristics of the relationship between horses and humans is the fact that prey and predator can coexist in harmony. What horses have taught me as a person is stillness, is the idea of connecting with others in a way, whether they're people who are like-minded or who have opposing views. It's allowed me to integrate those ideas in a way that will make sense to me and that I could hopefully benefit from. And I don't mean that in a selfish way. Mm-hmm. I mean grow as a person and as an artist. Mm-hmm. Horses have taught me stillness. They've taught me how to become a better listener, which of course is a fundamental quality to being a filmmaker, and particularly a documentarian.
Mm-hmm. I thought maybe there was a double entendre in the title of Herd. You could add an A.
Yes.
And right? Yeah. And
absolutely.
Yeah. So you are heard within the silence of the herd loudly in this film, even in the quiet, even just with the birds chirping. It's just so gorgeous, and the interactions are happening all over. One woman had lost her son, and you just saw healing happening within her, just being at peace and being around others that kind of understood. Horses are great at understanding life and death. They do remind us to breathe, and they talk to us about living and dying and how to mourn, but how to get over it too. And I think a lot of that came out in the films. Both of them, really. I think both of them said a lot about how it is to be with horses and how they make you better people.
Well, the word herd is both a noun and a verb, right? And so there's a passive quality to it as well as an active quality. It's meant to evoke the duality of that idea and of that experience. It's not finite. It's a constant exchange, and it's a fluid exchange.
I love that. I love that. I think one of the most common questions Dad gets about the title for his book, The Man Who Listens to Horses, people want to, in their brains, they want to change it. Is that the book, The Man Who Talks to Horses? You know, they want to flip it around. And once they get it, they understand what listening is about. So you guys are you have parallel universes in that, I think, too. But I appreciate this. So tell us a little bit about where you're going to be next. I think you said next week you're going off to another film festival. You've just got back from San Diego, a beautiful festival there. How did you do with films?
Both films were received with open arms prior to the festival. The festival organizers were thrilled to be able to include them in the presentation of the festival itself. And the audiences were extremely receptive. Mm. And I've been joking that I was a bit of a hug dispensing machine after each film, because people come to me in tears or fighting back tears, sharing stories that they claim that they hadn't told anyone or, you know, hadn't thought of for years, but that were prompted by watching the film. It had just moved them to tears, and even Monty, for that matter, if I can be so bold, came to me after Herd, and he said, you know what, I got to do more of what you do in my work with horses that you do in your filmmaking. So, I mean, that was certainly more than flattering. That was, I don't know, it floored me, obviously, to receive that kind of a compliment, that kind of an endorsement from Monty.
He meant it.
So, yeah, San Diego Film Festival just finished. We did extremely well. And then next week, I'm going to Indianapolis for the Heartland Film Festival, which is an Oscar qualifying film festival in Indianapolis.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we are so pleased to have been honored to have you on our show. And we hope that you'll come back with some more work and more awards and more knowledge and grow as a person and share it all with us. So maybe we can grow up a little bit with you. Stéphane Morin.
I certainly hope so. And if I may share with your audience that there's still ways of staying in touch with me directly or indirectly through the websites for the films.
Yes, please give us.
Well, for Herd, it's easy to remember. It's herdfilm.com. And for Blindspot, it's blindspotfilm.com. They're very easy to remember.
Yeah, and it's H-E-R-D. We should, since I confused it that way. Yeah, H-E-R-D-film.com. And blindspotfilm.com. Okay. And do you have a Facebook page, or is it websites only? Or
They both have Facebook pages. They both have Twitter pages. All and there's direct links to the ranch in Argentina where we film Blindspot. And there's a direct link to the Equinicity Retreats on the Herd film.com page, which is where we filmed Herd, of course. There's all kinds of information. And in fact, in the case of the Blindspot film.com page, it's a fully accessible page. By that I mean it was designed with the visually impaired user in mind, so it's both extremely beautiful but also very intuitive for as an interface with that
That's
in mind.
Wonderful. That is wonderful and so thoughtful. Thank you so much, Stéphane Morel. I just so appreciate you, and we will have you on again. Please don't hesitate. Stay in touch, and maybe I would love to have you to Flag Us Up Farms in the spring, in May, if you're open to it. I'll send you some dates, because we want to have a little reunion of all those wonderful people that we've met involved in the film festival. So hold a date in May for us.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Debbie, and thank you, Jen.
Whisper the language of the herd. Listen, you don't have to say a word.
It's time for Jamie Jennings to fetch an email from Monty Roberts' inbox and share a morsel of Monty's wisdom in a little segment we like to call Ask Monty.
Leave this world a better place than mine. The magic in the language of
Dear Monty, I attended one of your demonstrations recently and was anxious to learn every detail of your work. I sailed boats as a kid, and I heard you mention a few knots that you said were useful. Can you please tell me which ones you use and why? Monty's answer. Knots are a subject that I often visit during the course of one of my demonstrations. I believe it is essential that every horse person has a good working knowledge of the essential half dozen or so knots that are most often used when working with horses. The bowline is a knot that, in my opinion, anyone calling himself a horseman absolutely must understand. It's a knot that can be tied around the horse's neck, and no matter how hard they pull, it won't allow the rope to get tighter. Thus, it is virtually impossible for the horse to choke himself with the bowline knot. It is also true that no matter how much pressure is applied to the rope, the bowline, unlike many knots, will remain in such a state that it is easy to untie. One can put a bowline knot in a rope, tow a truck with it, and then pop it loose very easily. In the world of tying horses up, there are several slip knots that can be employed. One will tighten up on the post and another won't. Some are easier to untie if the horse is in trouble, and some are more difficult. One should become familiar with two or three of the best slip knots to use when tying a horse to a post, tree, or hitch rack. The clove hitch is a knot that has several forms and applications. It has many uses in the horse industry, and one should become familiar with it. The clove hitch can be used in combination with various slip knots. It is the type of knot that would keep a rope from sliding down a sleek pole that a horse is tied to. In sailing, one must become familiar with dozens of knots. It doesn't seem too much to ask that a horseman become familiar with the variation of three knots, whose use will dramatically improve the safety of both people and horses. The knowledge of the bowline, the slip knot, and the clove hitch is essential for every horse person.
Hi, I'm Monty Roberts, and I'm dedicated to training horses without pain. You can learn to do it too on my Equus Online University. Western, English, the beginner, or the advanced rider, it doesn't matter. You can connect with other students online too, on our forum, and there's a new lesson every week. It's a lifetime of learning for you on my Equus Online University at MontyRoberts.com.
What in the wide, wide world of sports is going on here? Yeah.
Where in the world is Monty Roberts?
Monty is looking forward to meeting some new friends, two-legged and four-legged, January 6, 2018. This is a new one, West Coast Dressage Festival Masterclass Series. Monty will demonstrate his expertise and skill, first in Temecula, California at Galway Downs. That's pretty exciting. He'll be there with Boyd Martin, a rock star, a three-day eventer. And then April 21, he will be in the Thousand Oaks area of California at El Campion Farms with some rock stars there too, so watch for that and links. And then July 23 through August 3, 2018, he'll be at his Gentling Wild Horses course at Flag Is Up Farms in California. And then August 6 through 10, right after that, August 6 through 10, 2018, is the Monty's Special Training. We've been doing that since 2006 at Flag Is Up Farms in California.
And there's been a lot of special training going on all that while.
Yes. A lot of good horses.
Now, too. In case you were not able to commit that all to memory, you can find all of that and more at MontyRoberts.com. Or if you want to talk to somebody, that's right. They have real human beings at Flag Is Up Farms. You can give them a call. And the phone number is 805-688-6288. And by the way, if you can't commit that to memory because you're busy doing something else, go to MontyRoberts.com and the phone number's there too.
Ta-da! It is. Under context.
Under context. That's right. And for details about today's show, go to horsemanshipradio.com where you'll find links, photos, and more information about our guests. And guess what? We still want your feedback. We say that every episode and we still want more. Go to Facebook, type in Monty Roberts, and then click the like button and type in there what you want us to talk about, topics, interesting people, fun stuff, cute pictures. We love those too.
Yeah.
That's right. And if you are someone who likes to live your life 150 characters at a time, you can follow Monty Roberts on Twitter. His handle is Monty_Roberts. And so that you don't miss any episodes, those are the episodes that you help us make better by going to Facebook and Twitter. Get the app. The Horse Radio Network app is free and easy to use and available for Android and iPhone. Go to your app store today and search Horse Radio Network and download that sucker. And you can also subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcatcher.
Look at that, podcatcher. Yeah. And many thanks to our sponsors, too, who probably have apps of their own. So that is Omega Fields, Cavallo Horse and Rider, and Monty's Equus Online University. And be sure to visit all the other great shows on the Horse Radio Network, too, at www.horseradionetwork.com. Until next time, have many happy horse hours.